Welcome to Film Fight Club. I'm Glenn Falkenstein from Falcon Screen, and we are joined, as always, by freelance writer and critic Virat Nehru.
Yee-hoo, people!
And Sydney filmmaker Chris Evans.
Hello.
Now, we have a big show planned. We are talking Kodachrome, which screened at the American Essentials Film Festival and is in cinemas in the coming weeks.
June 7, I believe.
June 7, the opening day of the Sydney Film Festival, or second day of the Sydney Film Festival.
It's going to be a really tough choice, as we'll discuss.
Yeah, really tough.
What do we do? And then the next film, and we're also talking about Deadpool 2 in a moment. We will also be having a discussion about the new Diablo Cody film, Tully. This is a difficult one to discuss without spoilers, so we will be doing a spoiler-free discussion followed by a spoiler-filled discussion. But you don't want to hear spoilers full pelt on the radio, so guys, how are we going to manage this?
Okay, it's been a long time coming. But
drum roll, we are on iTunes. You can look us up. We're there. Film Fight Club. It's just Film Fight Club. The only Film Fight Club. Every single episode is on iTunes, so you can look up the last one, or you could just stream us all for like I don't know how many hours.
Yeah,
and just hear
binge
it.
Listen
yeah,
to
subscribe.
Us.
You know, you don't have to listen to 2SER anymore, ever again. Abandon community. Abandon community radio.
Keep listening to 2SER. I'm turning off this mic here.
No. Please do keep listening to 2SER because they're keeping us on the air.
But also,
and we would not be on iTunes if no one listened to us on 2SER.
But also, I have it on proper authority. If you hate Apple and you're an Android person, you can still listen to us through Podcatcher. So, you know, if you like to get your iPod fixed through Android, you can still search for our podcast, Film Fight Club, and you'll find us there.
Or if you can't use anything that's on an iPhone like myself, then you can listen to us on a regular iPhone and just binge like Netflix, just all. Through the year of movies with us.
Yeah, yep. You know, and we're really funny. And
sometimes,
you know, always.
Always, sometimes funny.
Always, yeah. We're
reliably, sometimes funny. That should be our slogan.
We're funny 40% of the time, all the time.
Yes. 40% funny, 100% dudes.
So, oh, so true. So
we actually wanted to break the patriarchal film, you know, Fight Club down again this episode with a female guest, but we repelled all women within a few kilometers of us, so we were unable to get a guest for this episode.
But what we will be doing is
hashtag not all radio shows.
But you'll get to hear three guys discuss the issues of childbirth and post-maternal depression tonight.
Tully. Spoiler-free for the end of the show, and then in podcast form, look it up. Spoiler filled.
Skip to the 30-minute mark and there you'll have it.
Yeah.
But we will be having many, many more guests on during the Sydney Film Festival, where we'll be doing a great deal more coverage than usual. It's going to be a lot of fun.
Yeah, this is pretty much the last episode you're going to get of our regular show before we just get taken over by a Sydney Film Festival. So you know what that means.
Extended coverage.
Not just that. I don't have to watch Solo. Yes.
Oh,
Solo.
I'm still keeping. I'm not going to lie.
Solo.
But we are not talking about Solo. We are talking
ever.
We are talking about another crazy, ridiculous film which had some interesting development stories going around it, and that is Deadpool.
Another movie where the directors were fired.
Right.
Both of those, Solo and Deadpool 2, both had the original directors fired.
Wow.
Oh, I didn't realize that. So it doesn't bode well for the film. It may be reflected in certain elements of it. This is the sequel to the 2016 hit Deadpool, Deadpool 2, The Second Coming. It is starring Ryan Reynolds as Deadpool or Deadpool as Ryan Reynolds. We're really not sure at this point. It's all a little bit mixed up.
I think they're both the same person by this point. Yes, Ryan Reynolds is Deadpool.
Ryan Reynolds is, he's channeling it. He's credited as co-writing the script of this one.
Wow. Which means he basically just ad-libbed a whole bunch of sequences, which I can very well believe.
Redeeming himself for all those Green Lantern times.
Oh, as they did explicitly in this film, which was one of the more hilarious moments. This also stars Josh Brolin as Deadpool's arch-nemesis Cable, New Zealand's Julian Dennison of Hunt for the Wilder People fame, and Zazie Beetz as Domino, one part of the X-Force team. Now, in terms of the plot, it's very similarly along the lines of the first film. Same line, same shtick. What to expect goes Deadpool, got a Deadpool.
Very similar comedy to the original film.
Yeah, there's a lot of issues with this. In summary, I would say, if you see this, and you like the first film, you won't be disappointed. That's not a criticism. It's
if you
just,
like Deadpool 1,
yeah, it's just not the best thing that can be said about it. But what you would like to say about it, but is, unfortunately.
Josh Brolin's abs in this movie.
You mean Thanos?
Yeah, no, just his abs. Fantastic.
Well, he's good in this.
I mean, and good looking. That's what I'm trying to say.
This was a bit of a mixed bag, I would say. The action is... I mean, okay, full disclosure, I didn't like Deadpool 1, and as we were saying before, this is really more of the same, so I didn't like Deadpool 2. But first, what's better about it than Deadpool 1? The action, it's now directed by David Leitch, who co-directed John Wick 1.
One of the guys who killed John Wick's dog, according to the
opening credits. And it's a big upgrade on the action in Deadpool, the original. I actually thought a lot of the action sequences in this are very engaging and pretty creative and fun to watch. In fact, I'd say they're some of the best I've seen in recent superhero movies, if not the best.
The scenes involving Domino and how luck as a superpower is used are really creative.
Hilarious.
And I really, really enjoyed it.
There's a really good highway chase, as well as a long physical brawl between Deadpool and Josh Brolin, which... surprised me because those hand-to-hand kind of slugfests are usually...
No shaky cam.
Yeah, are usually really boring in superhero movies, but I actually thought this was just simple and fun to watch.
Well, I actually took issue with some of the action scenes because David Leitch, and from John Wick, and as you saw in Atomic Blonde, has this incredibly kinetic thrill where the camera doesn't shy away, it's very upfront, and it's very physical hand-to-hand combat. This was evident with Cable, Brolin's character, but not so much with Deadpool, because there they can go the full gamut of having him do ridiculous outlandish things when someone's body could literally fall apart and get back together. And it was the same with some of the other characters. I found this prison sequence with Brolin was outstanding for
that.
But it wasn't all the other sequences I didn't find were up to that level, up to scratch.
Right. I think there are major problems with the plot of this movie and how that relates to the constant fourth wall breaking that Deadpool does. Okay. Basically, the plot in this is really, really stupid. I think the original Deadpool got by on a very simple formulaic revenge movie plot, which I thought was satisfying enough to watch.
It was a better version of Taken.
Yeah, it's, you know, Deadpool has to get back at the people who did something to him. You know, it follows all the beats, but was done in a competent, satisfying manner. This has essentially no story, you know.
There's no villain.
Well,
no, there is.
No, there being no villain, I don't think is a problem, because there's antagonists and there's stakes for Deadpool to go against. But basically, the movie is about Deadpool becoming attached to and trying to protect a kid. But the whole movie is in this really ironic register, so it doesn't sell the sincere emotion you need for this idea of Deadpool bonding with or feeling like he needs to be the guardian or protector of this kid. So, and his motivation for doing so is because he hears it in a riddle. A riddle in a dream. I thought, are you serious?
It's interesting you say that, because I felt the emotion in this film was probably more heartfelt than the first movie. I think that connects, and especially Deadpool actually feeling the consequences of his actions in the beginning, was probably one of the more somber moments in the entire franchise. Can we call it a franchise?
That opening... Sorry, I'd like to hear what Glenn says.
Oh, no, I'm more inclined to agree with Chris for the simple reason that the issue becomes that Deadpool is a film which is at its best when it is going for its marked irreverence, what the character in the comics is known for. The kid storyline is very, very similar to a very popular science fiction film from about 6 years ago, which you will know and recognize as soon as you begin to watch this film.
It's also very similar to Terminator, as the movie is. It makes pains to reference.
And that's just the thing. I mean, when you do cultural references, it's fine so much when you don't have T.J. Miller or someone else to quite literally point it out. But
can we just, like, ban T.J. Miller from appearing in anything?
The emotional stakes which they were going for is you can't balance with the incredibly irreverent tone that they try to do but only got halfway throughout some of the film.
Yeah, agreed. Virat is saying that at the beginning of the film, you know, you feel the stakes, and I agree with that, but because the movie exists in this Deadpool so zany and wacky, he's constantly referring to the fact that he's in a bad comic book movie. We pretty much gloss over that, you know, that emotional depth immediately. Like, there's a big opening credit sequence which goes into wacky parody mode, and then after that it's pretty much forgotten about. It's meant to be the motivating and instigating incident for Deadpool, and then it just doesn't matter that much.
I think you're right. In terms of tone, this movie is kind of all over the place.
All over the place,
because
yeah.
They don't know exactly what's the balance they need to strike in terms of irreverence or sincerity.
Yeah.
But at the same time, I felt this movie was more sincere than the first one. The first one was trying too hard actually establish the convention that's trying to break.
There's some nice, you know, more emotional scenes relating to Deadpool's relationship, you know, towards the end of the movie, but the movie really tries to have it both ways, because it seems to be going for
this Deadpool joke there, Chris.
It seems to be going in this, like, you know, well, yeah, this plot is stupid. Deadpool points out that it's bad writing or whatever, you know, so it's fine. But no, it's not good enough to just acknowledge that you're stupid. If you're going to poke fun at how bad the writing is, first of all, wouldn't it be more satisfying to see an actually well-written movie with a good story? And secondly, this movie is not smart enough to get away with that. It still adheres to stupid cliches, like the instigating incident, which I'm not going to reveal because it's a big spoiler that they've tried to hide in the marketing. It's a pretty dumb movie. It's about Deadpool trying to stop someone from getting a taste for murder by killing a bunch of dudes.
But the thing is,
it's stupid if you think about it for a moment.
Well, it's engaging to an extent, but it's not as engaging when you see the shtick the exact same time around. I refer to the opening credit sequence, and I enjoyed it the first time, but I've seen it the second time, and you refer to the marketing campaign. There's the second film now where the marketing campaign is far and beyond more interesting than the actual film. The Celine Dion song, Deadpool trolling Eurovision, tying with Manchester United, take you over Colbert's monologue, taking over South Korean singing competition is a unicorn.
Okay, I like
still not as good as 50 Shades Freed, though.
Look, there was an early trailer for this movie where Cable appeared without his CGI, and then Deadpool stopped and reenacted it, you know, a scene of him fighting Cable with action figures while he put the CGI in the microwave, and when it was ready, then Cable, you know, the movie, it resumed with Cable.
Yeah, that was great.
Yeah, that's clever. That's creative kind of fourth wall breaking. What we get in Deadpool is basically a standard superhero movie that isn't really even genuinely a comedy. It's just a standard action movie, except that Deadpool looks to the camera and makes reference to the DC universe being bad,
or dubstep or something, Thanos, which just gets very tiring.
Yeah, exactly. It's not written as a genuine, clever comedy.
It's written like a series of pop culture references.
Exactly. It's very Family Guy. there's a sequence in the middle of this film which is a genuine creative comedy sequence, which is very dark, involving a...
Yeah, I was about to say it, yeah.
Yeah, involving an operation gone wrong, which shows what this movie could have been if it had been written around comedy set pieces, and how much better it had potential to be.
It's a parody of every single... These action sequences appear in a lot of the Fast and Furious, James Bond-type films.
Exactly,
and they're taking
the
piss out of it in a way that is actually quite legitimate, because this is what happens in the film would likely transpire in real life.
That's right. The dubstep reference you made reminded me of something. There's a line at the end of this movie where they say, okay, you're probably going to go home now and look up what dubstep is. And I thought, well, everyone's watching this knows what dubstep is, but hang on, they're probably saying that for people in the future who are going to be watching this movie, because dubstep will be dated and forgotten about by then. But then hang on, that made me think, how is anybody going to make any sense of this movie in the future? It's going to be so dated because all of the script is about references to current pop culture. This is such a disposable film by design.
But isn't that the point? The point is that instant gratification is enough.
You can be irreverent but still be endearing.
I agree. Okay.
But there's no irreverence. I think it is purely to satisfy, you know, the hit list for current affairs. Like, this is what's going on right now, and tick all the boxes.
Exactly.
It's not even going for irreverence. There's no actually...
I don't think there's not much wit to it. It's just very simple. Like, you get the laugh of, ha ha, I recognize that. I agree that DC is bad.
Yeah, this is more like Ready Player One, actually, in that sense.
Actually, one more note on that. They make fun of Batman versus Superman for the stupid way that it keeps the heroes fighting against each other. Until, we realize that both of our mothers' names are Martha. But this movie is actually just as bad in the way that it artificially keeps its antagonist and protagonist fighting against each other. Cable and Deadpool keep battling, but if they had stopped for even a moment before they started coming to blows to say, hey, why are you doing this? And you know, exchanged a few words with each other, we'd skip right through till the third act in terms of the plot progression of this movie. The most of the film is just Deadpool and Cable, because they've never spoken to each other at all or said more than like a few grunts, just fighting each other constantly.
It's weird.
This is just stupidity.
But also a weird sort of acknowledgement of male toxicness.
No, don't give Deadpool that much credit.
No,
this
I don't
just
think
idiocy.
So either.
But I think from our perspective, just acknowledging that you know, as dudes, they need to fight it out rather than actually talk to each other.
But look, I think movies should not be motivated in their plot by characters being stupid, unless that's actually the point of the movie. And Verrett, you're talking about it as if the point is, oh, they're toxic males and they're stupid. But no, they're just stupid for the sake of creating action sequences.
This is the thing. Deadpool, the cachet of it, the cultural cachet of the character has always been taking the Mickey out of superhero grand scale design. And what I was frustrated about the first one was that it was trying to take the piss out of this, it ended on this ridiculously big blustering finale. It didn't do that here, and I appreciate that.
Yep.
But it fell under so many of the constraints and just things that superhero films rely on, that it is trying to lampoon,
exactly,
but doesn't.
Creating villains where they don't need to be a villain, as we see with Cable.
Yeah.
You know,
the whole school thing, like, yeah.
Yeah. So that is Deadpool 2. It is in cinemas now. The one of the elements I did enjoy, aside from a brief appearance by Tragedy Girls, Brianna Hildebrand, who is excellent, is the one character in this film who I feel actually developed and was more interesting this time around, and that was the taxi driver, Dupinder, who was absolutely hilarious. And we are going to play a song which featured in his cab in the film. Rob, what is this?
This is called Yuhi Chala Chal Rahi, which is also an A.R. Rahman number. So I am going to continue with my A.R. Rahman reference.
Enjoy. We'll be right back.
अब तुझसे ये रास्ता है कह रहा अब मुझसे मिलने को है कोई कहीं अब तुझसे
And we are back on Film Fight Club. The next film we are talking about is Kodachrome, which came to the American Essentials Film Festival, and it's in cinemas from June 7. It is starring Jason Sudeikis as a record producer at a low point in his life. He has not spoken in quite some time to his famous photographer father, played by Ed Harris. His father's personal assistant and nurse, played by Elizabeth Olsen, enters Jason Sudeikis' character's life to tell him that his father is dying and that he wants to go to the last place in the world that develops Kodachrome rolls of photos. He has four rolls, which is in Kansas, so as in every independent film, you need a road trip.
Here we go.
On which they embark. This is... Okay, so a few months ago, they took the fellow from Silicon Valley and made an AI wrote a film called Sunspring. It absorbed hundreds of screenplays from science fiction, film, and television and put it into one short, and the AI regurgitated what he thought a science fiction short should be. If you put thousands of indie scripts into...
Sundance movie, specifically Sundance...
into an AI and put it together, you'd probably get something a few notches below this. This hits every single recognizable beat of every indie movie.
Man, oh my God. All right. American cinema is doomed.
You heard it here first.
Yeah, I heard it here first. Like, remember when independent film was meant to be about getting away from formula?
Yeah.
You know, now the studios have reached a point where they're producing so much samey product that the indies have moved up to filling in with, you know, to create the other kinds of formula movies that the studios have stopped making, and rather than presenting anything new or different. Remember when an independent film would be something like Five Easy Pieces or Blue Velvet? Like something...
David Lynch actually reference. Out of the box.
Something out of the box and interesting. My God, how the mighty have fallen.
It's interesting in that sense because I feel like this is paralleled, this kind of... in the literature scene as well, of the great American novel, which is always about the Midwest. And I feel, you know, it's all about these characters, especially male protagonists, kind of finding themselves and having some kind of generational issues. And you know, with Franzen being the great American novelist, it's essentially the same. And I feel a lot of that is now seeping into the great indie American movie.
And I'm fine with intergenerational film, except for the fact that the only two characters, the Ed Harris and Jason Sudeikis characters, are the ones with anything beyond a one-dimensional plane. All the other characters, including the two other main characters played by Elizabeth Olsen and Dennis Haysbert, are absolutely Deus Machina roles. There's an incredibly forced romance, but in terms of Dennis Haysbert, who's a superb actor, he basically rocks up, and there's a point where they say he kind of just knows everything. He's the guy who introduces things to the plot when you just need him introduced. He has absolutely no function beyond this.
Yeah, Look, this is an incredibly lazy screenplay. It's essentially every cliche that comes to mind when you think of a dysfunctional family road trip movie. Or any it's this year's Little Miss Sunshine.
Yeah, there's actually plot beat points, point for point, of Little Miss Sunshine in the Little Miss Sunshine
meeting August Osage County, maybe?
No, not August Osage County. More like any kind of like grumpy dad was an asshole, but then...
What was the Bruce Dern movie from a few years back?
Nebraska. But Nebraska was way better than this.
Oh, yeah, of course.
So much more depth than this.
Yeah. But then, like, every movie has grumpy dad who's American, so I guess it's too many movies in
okay,
one.
Okay, like, well, in saying that it's predictable, I should clarify a bit here. Like, last week I was singing the praises of Speed Racer, which is about as predictable as you can get. So I don't think that predictability is inherently a bad thing. But I think when I criticize a movie for being predictable, what I mean is that it's delivering exactly what you imagine and never going above that. You can see everything about what this movie is going to do, and then it never adds any kind of twist, either in the aesthetics and presentation or in the character dynamics. They're exactly as you would imagine. And the problem is that, yeah, you begin to see the path, the very straight path that this convertible is driving along very quickly, because once the rhythm of the character introductions is established, they simply repeat. It feels very repetitive until changes in the dynamic happen all too quickly, just because now it's required by the beats in the script. It doesn't feel like a genuine development in terms of progression that changes the characters into different people.
I'm going to try to segue from this to try and say something positive about this movie, even though it's very difficult to do so. Let's talk about Jason Sudeikis, because he's transformed himself into this dramatic actor with quite a lot of interesting roles. I mean, the first sort of inkling we had of that was when he did this film with Alison Brie, Sleeping with Other People, which was genuinely funny, and he had this great role. And then with Nacho Vigalondo film with Anne Hathaway, and that was fantastic. He was scary in that movie, and I really bought him as this kind of, you know, this nice fuckboy image, which he really created on screen, which is interesting to begin with. And now in this sort of a dramatic role. So I really give him chops for his role experimentation, and is really diversified as an actual dramatic actor.
I wasn't sold by him, to be honest, in this.
I wasn't particularly either. I think Ed Harris was better. I think Elizabeth Olsen was better in parts, even though her performance in Infinity War was much more compelling. Honestly,
yeah,
it was. She was
her character just isn't that interesting in this. Yeah, you know, the attempt to give her depth is just there for, now it's time for the third act, you know, late second act complication, rather than because you believe that she's that kind of complicated character. And it's all stuff you've seen before, as is everything else in this movie.
And I agree that the issue was that they introduced conflict for the sake of conflict, but on the Sudeikis character and his performance, he was fine. I am impressed at his career trajectory, but you can only be so good as at times as your material allows. He plays this figure we've seen so many times before. A literal plot point of his figure turns on having to bemoan how music isn't what it used to be.
Oh, man.
And there's a similar dynamic with the Ed Harris character, who will only develop portraits and photography in a certain method. He's bemoaning the decline of artistry as he knows it.
Jesus Christ. You're mentioning one of the most annoying things about this movie.
But isn't this the kind of postmodern sort of dichotomy of living, where we kind of always in glorification mode about some kind of nostalgia that we...
Yeah, except
that
the movie...
They drive it home.
But the movie is like celebrating the character's belief in that. Like, it's a good, you know...
Yeah,
but Jason Sudeikis stands for, like, remember the time when there were real rock bands playing real music with loud guitars? And Ed Harris is, remember the time when we didn't use these damn-fangled digital thingamabobbies and I used real chemical processes?
Damn it. Pixels.
Like, all right, we get it. You're trying to appeal to the people who would go to see movies at indie cinemas. Everything about this movie is so goddamn calculated. I didn't feel any kind of like genuine love from the director of this film in terms of like the process of chemical, you know. Actually, on that note, for a movie that's called Kodachrome and it's about photography, what a visually uninteresting movie.
Oh,
like,
yeah.
How about a scene, you know, even showing like the photochemical processes of developing the photos at the end? That could have been a father-son bonding moment. Something like that to really get us into his love, instead of just having him say, yes, I love photochemical processes. It's all like the simple way and show nothing.
But there was one real bonding moment, and it was one organic moment which took place in a hotel room. Remember, Chris and I looked at each other as we saw this, and it was in the hospital, and it was funny.
Oh, that was great,
and
yeah.
It was a turn of the script, but otherwise it felt like they were going block by block, paint
exactly,
by numbers.
Yeah.
Yeah, but... It's dads, you know. Dads need to say "I love you" to their son because that's the resolution. It's always been that way.
So quite.
Speaking of, no, the resolution of this movie was such a groaner. Like the act, the final scene. It's like you can see it coming from so far away. But then, so it maybe could have worked if they'd really underplayed the moment. But instead, they portray it like it's this huge. Operatic kind of transcendent experience with the pounding soundtrack and
we can have a similar criticism of Tully in a few minutes.
Yeah, but you know, you can just see how this came to be when in the end credits it's like, okay, so it's based on this New York Times report about people flooding to the last place where the Kodagram could be developed, and you're looking, okay, so some screenwriters said, let's turn that into a road trip movie, father and son bonding, and oh, I know what the finale is going to be. You get to see the photos that the father is giving to the son. Guess what it's going to be.
Yeah,
if you can figure it out from what I'm saying now, then, you know...
You've seen the film.
You've seen the film.
Yeah.
And it's fine when a film has the dramatic integrity to know that it doesn't rest on twists and rests on your investment in the characters. This thought that it all rested on what the final reveal was, and yeah. The final reveal was very lax.
Also, very obvious. Like, we've seen that in a lot of movies.
And I think you guys just had too high expectations out of this indie film. I mean, you guys were expecting Kelly Reichardt, and this is just any other normal American indie movie.
No,
sorry. This is what the majority of the output is. Like.
Yeah, but that's why cinema's doomed.
And this thing, but it was so derivative of those films.
Yeah, I
and
felt like this was just... I would not, you know, I never thought about this movie except every now and again to go, my God, that was bad.
And I've got to say, for a road trip movie, there was no, except for the very end, there was no conception of distance travel. There was no actual bits on the road. Yeah. It was only at a motel room or
montages of the cars, car driving along.
Whenever you think an indie movie can be bad, just remember Jason Segel played David Foster Wallace in the end of the tour, and nothing can be worse than that.
So that was Kodachrome. It is in cinemas on June 7. Our selling point is it's not as bad as the David Foster Wallace film.
Or David Foster Wallace in real life.
Oh, David Foster Wallace. We keep bringing him. He's the new David Lynch of the show. The last film we are talking about in our last few minutes in the spoiler-free version is Tully. We'll get into much more detail in our podcast. Just continue listening afterwards. You'll hear us. Tully is the new film, the third collaboration from... Juno, director and writer Jason Reitman and Diablo Cody, and the second collaboration between the pair and Charlize Theron following Young Adult. The plot, we won't go into too much detail. Charlize Theron plays Marlo, who is very freshly on maternity leave, expecting her third child with husband Ron Livingston. They have two other children, their first of which their son requires quite a bit more attention than other children typically do. Marlo's wealthier brother offers to fund for her a night nanny. Tully, played by Mackenzie Davis of Blade Runner fame, and also probably the most highly acclaimed Black Mirror episode, San Junipero. We've been discussing it privately. We've had some quite big differences on our views on this film, so I'm really looking forward to getting into it. I found the performances very good. I had a lot of major issues with this, but there were also parts I liked a lot. I found it, broadly speaking, very mixed.
Look, I thought the opening of this is very effective in delving into a subject that we don't usually see explored on film. The way that this movie shows us all the stresses in Tully's life, having to deal with a kid who's acting up and is difficult to deal with, and then a new baby, and then a dad who isn't around as much as he should be or paying enough attention to her, you start to really feel it. I feel like the direction was pretty spot on as well. I had a sense of doom. You know, there's this growing sense that things are going to just cave in her life. I was concerned watching it. It's very effective at that point, maybe a little bit, you know, too quippy in the script. But otherwise, at that moment, I was on board.
Okay, it's my turn to be the alternative voice in this panel. On this panel. Oh, I hated this film.
You're not the alternative voice. I hated it too.
Yeah. I mean
yeah, didn't you like it early on?
Yeah, the first third of the movie, the first 20 or 30 odd minutes, I was getting on board. And I think that's why I hated it more. Because I think it sort of lulled me into feeling that I might like it. It was deception. It was almost like I was, you know, betrayed by a movie. And I, you know, not like a real person, but almost like that. It felt like I was getting into a relationship without realizing what I was getting into. And, you know, I was betrayed in the end.
So as you can hear already, very diverse points of view on this. So please, if you are listening to 2SER Live, just continue listening for all the wonderful programming. But if you'd like to hear our much more in-depth spoiler discussion of this film, it is in cinemas now. You can go to find us Film Fight Club on iTunes and podcasts everywhere.
If you aren't going to see the movie, but you just like hearing bitchy takedowns, please listen to our Tully discussion.
We will be back.
This is a very bitchy takedown.
We will be back next week with City Film Festival director Nashan Mealy talking in much more detail about the City Film Festival program. Deadpool 2 is in cinemas now, and Kodachrome will be in cinemas on June 7th. Have a wonderful night. Enjoy movies. Good night. And we are back on our podcast extended discussion talking about
Tully,
new Diablo Cody film. This is a spoiler discussion. So if you haven't seen the film, we strongly recommend you avoid spoilers and come back and listen
unless
to us on podcast.
Unless you're never
going to
watch it or you don't care, in which case, here
I
we
don't
go.
Don't want to see very possible. A movie.
So, Tully, I think we're each going to talk for a little bit about our general views in this film and then throw the discussion open like we did with Mother and some of the particularly divisive films we have done.
Mother, that's a very good thing.
yeah, because very different film talking about...
Very different view on motherhood.
Very different take on motherhood. So, yeah. Tully, for me, is essentially about two things. One is motherhood and the characteristics of early motherhood from a... dramatic practical perspective. The other is regarding the thematic elements of it, which includes that, but is also related to the issue of health and more specifically mental health. The film deals with this in very broad terms. I liked in part its depiction of the issue of mental health. I found that there's an amazing film 2 years back. My favorite 2016 film is a film called Swiss Army Man, which deals with some of the similar issues in this film, I think, in a very intelligent way, in that it deals with, it says, if you issues regarding mental health, they're not something to be shunned under the carpet or sidelined to overcome, but more importantly, to be understood. And I feel it's a very mature and very good approach to these issues, which is very rarely covered in film. I feel Tully at least set out to do this, which I find very admirable. I found it endearing. I did, however, take issue with how the plot was executed. We were talked earlier in this episode about Kodachrome and how the film hinges on a reveal. This film hinges on a big twist that takes place in the third act.
M. Night Shyamalan worthy.
In that Shyamalan worthy, which is...
Actually, no. M. Night Shyamalan's twists are a lot better. You know, like this is more like the meme version of M. Night Shyamalan where people always talk about how terrible his twists are.
This is more like Adam Sandler Pixels twist.
Well, this is... Oh, that was a terrible film. But this twist is a dramatic ploy we have seen in so many
films.
She's
not real!
Including in this film, which we don't talk about, which is the podcast, is
exactly.
named after.
Exactly, I was about to say that.
Now... I don't have an issue with the twist in and of itself. There was a similar twist in Simon, except in that film, they knew that the appeal of the film to the character did not rest on the reveal. It rested on our investment in the narrative and in the characters. And I feel that was not handled as well. And there were clues throughout, which I felt were a little bit too blatant.
On the nose? Like the song that we used to lead you in, You Only Live Twice.
Yes, there is a cover of this in the film, and if you know the twist...
Look, we should explain it a little bit more clearly. It's called Tully because midway through, you know, near the beginning, the brother, it's Mark Duplass, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, of Catherine, Charlize Theron, who I should note is really good in this movie.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
The performance
she's fantastic.
Is one of the best things about the film. Not the best. Yeah, she's typically good. Mark Duplass says, hey, I know you're struggling, so how about you take on a night nanny? It's really helped us with the kids, and you know, I'll pay for it for you. He's her brother. She says, okay, and then Tully arrives, big-eyed manic pixie dream girl, and magically transforms Marlo's life, puts everything in order, gets the house together, and then it's revealed that Tully is in fact not a actual night nanny, but a manifestation of Marlowe's younger self who has come, you know, forward in time to help imagine, you know, through Marlowe's psyche to help her reunite with the past self that she lost touch with in after the stresses of childbirth.
I think, yeah.
Okay. I have lots and lots and lots and lots of issues with this movie, but I will begin somewhere. Firstly, to use the title characters, the character, Charlize Theron's name in this movie.
Marlowe.
Marlowe.
Oh, God.
Very obvious.
Detective novels.
Very obvious
Heart of Darkness.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking. I never picked up on that, actually.
And it goes into Kurtz and finds the meaning, you know, true meaning.
Damn.
Yeah, no. Wow. All right.
And you say...
How did I miss that?
And you think Kodachrome was derivative? I'm sorry, that hit me in the face like a sledgehammer. Ouch.
Tully isn't derivative in that way. This is just like poor referencing. This is more like Deadpool 2.
Sorry. That was really... I wish this was more like Deadpool 2. That would sort of make me sort of gulp it down slightly easier than I did. The second issue and the biggest issue I have with this movie is... how it uses mental illness to begin with. It's a pure functional plot device, and I'm sick, I am tired, and I am angry with movies that use mental illness as not something which is an actual condition that needs to be explored through the movie and the impact it has on people, but rather as a convenient twist or something that is meant to shock you. Yes, the eventual intended meaning may be to make people realize... how it makes people feel.
The stresses of childbirth.
Yes, but I think it really robs you of that real emotion by making it into a shock value twist. And, you know, it comes in the third act. If you need
it comes right at the end.
Yeah, if you need to explore the actual stresses of mental illness, introduce it early on so people can realize...
Fight Club did.
That's a good point. Introducing it at the very end means that the movie has no time to go into depth about what does this mean for the character.
Yes.
And it's in a rush to wrap things up with a tidy little bow at the end, which means that, yeah, this subject is you're cheated out of a real exploration of this subject.
I agree with that because I'll use this Simon example earlier. After following the twist in that, it was a third act, and you got to explore the impact on Paul Dano's character. I am going to disagree with you on the point of how it's used as a plot device, because I think the one character we have not spoken about in any detail at all is the son, who is not on screen a lot, but is a hugely significant character. And the film, as much as it's about the relationship between Marlowe and Tully, it's actually more about the relationship between her and her son. And there is a heartrending moment at the very end in this regard. Now, it is about how both characters are perceived. Both are suffering in their own way, and it is how they... relate to each other. I don't think it was a ploy that was thrown in. I think it was something that once you go back and watch it with the twist in mind in terms of interactions when Tully was present with others, whether it be at the bar in Brooklyn or even several of the scenes in the film, I found it more compelling than anything else. I do take issue with the plot machinations surrounding it. I think that it could have been executed better. But actually deploying this, which is as it is really seen in the film, I found very interesting.
Okay. God, where to start with this goddamn movie? All right. We're not on radio, right? So where to start with this piece of shit?
All right. I know how you feel. Yeah. I know how you feel.
Okay, here we go.
Here we go, indeed.
Yeah. All right. If I'm to be charitable with this movie, because as we've been discussing before, if we talk about this as a movie that's actually about issues of mental health, it really doesn't do it any favors. But if I'm to be charitable, I can say, okay, it's not really so much about, you know, literal postpartum psychosis as it is, an extended metaphor about getting back in touch with your younger self, right? That's a more charitable way to read it. But if I look at it that way, that raises a bunch of questions. Like, if this is just a metaphorical expression of Charlize Theron, Marlowe's past coming back to her, how come she never realizes that how come she never speaks to this person as if it is a person from her past until right at the end when the reveal is coming, you know, as if it's herself. So the movie pushes you in the direction of looking at this as if it's a literal occurrence within, or, you know, a real occurrence within her mind that she's having a psychosis of imagining this person is there. It's, we're also pushed in the direction of reading it that way by the way that the husband says at the end, while Charlize Theron is in hospital, that he's heard about her night nanny, but he's a bit confused about, you know, who she is. Like, I don't really know much about her. So the movie is trying to say, yes, this is a psychosis. It's a hallucination. She's, because the implication is that she's told her husband that the night nanny has come.
But the perception does change later in the film, as we learn in the hospital. So there is the progression in terms of how she perceives the figure. And it is arguable. I agree with your interpretation, but it is arguable that even at the early stages when she says things like, oh, you look so young, that she was very cognizant of who she was. It is open to interpretation, but I do take your view on this.
But let's talk about the husband.
One more point on that and before... Okay, the problem is with that husband thing in hospital is the movie is, you know, the whole premise doesn't make any sense. I know that the husband is neglecting Marlo in terms of how much time he spends with her, but I can't believe that he doesn't care about the raising of the child to the extent that he's not even going to look at or ask to see the person who's looking after her. The new baby, he's never seen her. He's never said, okay, you're leaving the it
could
happen.
Okay.
It could happen, but it's pushing the movie into, you know, into an unrealistic territory. I think a new father is going to want to see the person, you know, like, is this person a psychopath? The person who's looking after my baby?
More likely than this. More likely, yes, but not necessarily.
Okay. Let's talk about the husband, because how you perceive the husband will eventually shape how much you believe in the movie as such. The husband's character is presented as this kind of deadbeat person who is somewhat mildly okay in the sense that he cares about fatherhood, but he doesn't understand the responsibilities that come with it.
I think he cares about fatherhood enough that he would check at least on the person looking after the baby.
I think he would... He's one of those people who tries to tick boxes about, oh, you know, I've asked my wife and, you know, kissed her goodbye. I've made sure that I'm taking the lunch that she's made for me, rather than actually partaking in the responsibilities of being a father.
That's a fairly regular thing, unfortunately.
Yeah, and I can totally see that. But also at the same time, that's why I don't buy this random transformation that happened as soon as he realizes that Marlo is actually suffering with this mental illness.
Well, that's the whole problem of this movie in general. Everything has to be wrapped up in a way that reassures audiences on the way out instead of leaving us with any complications or questions.
There's nothing to indicate that he would abandon his routine of playing random video games at night instead of taking care of his kids and sharing responsibilities with Marlo. But suddenly at the end, they're shown in this happy montage kind of way of listening to iPod playlists together.
Look, the movie and sharing house cheats house. You out of any of the kind of big complications that are implied by the reveal at the end, because, as I keep saying, it's a race to the happy ending. So since I've said before, you know, this should be viewed as a literal story about mental illness as opposed to just an extended metaphor, it's completely robbing us of the significance of what's just been revealed. Tully's psychosis is severe enough that she's put her own life in danger, and she's theoretically going to put her own children's life in danger. You know, after she drives a car off a bridge because of a hallucination, you know, that's not the time for us to race to the happy ending. That's a sign of like severe mental imbalance. The movie really, it uses mental illnesses as a twist, and, you know, a reveal that as a way to impress us with the cleverness of its writing, and doesn't deal with the significance of what it's actually depicting.
Okay. I did address this in passing earlier, but I'm going to say, in terms of the plotting, in terms of the ending, I do agree that, and I would have been happy to see a longer film or have the twist revealed earlier. These are issues that should have been teased out and dealt with in much greater detail towards the end of the film. We should have seen a much more detail in terms of how it impacted on Tully. So on Marla and her family. I feel, as I said, this was dealt with much better in other films, including in the case in point is Sasami Man. In terms of the husband's transformation, I don't think there was a transformation at all. I think we saw him become cognizant, feel guilty, whatever, about what the impact of his inaction had clearly had on Marlo. And we saw maybe him starting to change. I don't think we've seen a revolution in his character. We've seen him potentially start changing, which is a good thing, but we have not seen all about turning these characters.
One of the closing images of this is like now they're preparing the food or washing up or whatever it was together.
Sharing the iPod.
The implication is like now, all right.
Fuck first thing. No, excuse me. It's the first thing. This is, he may change, he may relapse, we don't know. I feel like the movie implied this is the first thing he's done.
I think the movie definitely implies, even if it's the first thing he's done, it's such a rosy, literally like, hey, you know, blue, warm, soft light and a nice song on the soundtrack and a cutesy moment to end on. I think the implication is definitely like things have now changed for the better because of her mental imbalance, which I think is a kind of fucked up message.
We went from Juno to La La Land in like 1 second.
I don't think it is the happy ending it's you're putting it up to be. But I appreciate
it. It ends
that.
On a cutesy romantic image of like, you know, she's listening to an iPod, and then now he comes to share the load with her, and he takes the other earbud, so they're listening to music together while they do the work together, and there's warm golden light coming in through the window.
I think it was an improvement. I think it's far from ideal. I think it's saying things could get better, not things are better.
All right. I have another issue with this movie with regard to the way that I feel it tries to mask its twist. Its insistence on being clever instead of being honest in its storytelling. It's something, it could just be me, but it's something I'm surprised not to have seen other people bring up. I feel like this movie was really gay baiting the audience. This movie is trying to, in order to stop the audience from thinking ahead and predicting where this is going, it tries to trick you into thinking of other directions that the plot might potentially go, were Tully not to be revealed as a manifestation of Marlowe's psyche.
I remember when you said there's going to be, you know, a third act twist that's going to radically change your opinion of the movie. I thought that's what you're referring to, that they're going to. And when that threesome sequence happened, I'm like, here we go.
I think the movie is trying to set you on a course to think there's going to be a lesbian relationship between Tully and Marlo. There's a lot of hints towards it. You know, when Tully arrives, she's, you know, really big-eyed, constantly making up close eye contact with Marlo. You know, Marlo goes on to talk about how she, you know, was really, really in love with this girl when she was younger. You know, they're getting increasingly intimate till they're having, you know, late night drinking wine together in the spa moments. And then Tully becomes engaged in sexual activity with Marlo and her husband, right? It goes further into that when Tully is first appeared, the camera's sort of lingering over her butt and suggesting that Marlo's looking at it. Yep. And then later, so it's clearly setting you on the course of like, okay, there's going to be a lesbian attachment for that. And then they explain that in the dumbest way later on with a line of dialogue like where Marlo says to Tully, like, oh, your butt's going to sag as you get older, everything's going to change. No. That's not what that was about. That was about setting us up to believe that there's a sexual attraction between these.
All right.
These women.
I find this very curious. This is not something I had considered. I'm very, very interested in hearing this perception. I thought it was going to go one of two ways, either as it did, as it was very clear it would do within about 20 minutes of the reveal, that she would be a manifestation, or alternately, something much more
clever.
Sinister.
I guess you didn't take the bait.
It's not the direction I thought it would go. In terms of the threesome sequence that was referred to earlier, I look at that as more of a plot issue than a thematic issue, and I'll explain why. I did say earlier that I have a lot of issues with how this had panned out, and at this point of the film, when we're getting towards the third act, it, as Chris alluded to, it is very, very strange that the night nanny should never have met the father who's also living in the house. So there has to have been some interaction at one point, and this seems a way to do it. I appreciate the direction they were sort of going with this, and it was probably one of the better pieces of misdirection in the following scene. It does serve as a piece of misdirection when they're sitting downstairs and what we talked about last night. And in retrospect, you can look at that either way. I also appreciate that.
He just says, wasn't that weird what happened last night?
And that was one of the best pieces of misdirection
He's perfectly vague enough that we don't predict where it's going.
So I did appreciate that. I also appreciate that as this is a film, and I will say at this point that having spoken to... This is a film that many people will relate to differently, people empathize with differently, and certainly it's a film I can only empathize with to an extent. When I was coming out of it, I was chatting to Chris, and I remember saying to him that I felt it was predominantly an issue of mental health. I've since revised that opinion. I do believe it is predominantly a film about the issues of motherhood, but I feel I had that perception because this is a film I can only empathize with in certain ways to an extent.
I think theoretically this concept could have been an interesting way to look at the problems of, you know, like you lose who you are because of the stresses of life in general, and or specifically in this case, motherhood. But I think feel like the movie would have been better served if it had been honest. If, you know, even if Tully had just come out and said, look, I am you from your younger days. I'm here to help you get back in touch with the things you'd forgotten about, instead of trying to be more clever than its audience. I think that could have made for a much more satisfying narrative, and the plot wouldn't have had to twist itself in all these directions or, you know, quite offensively, I think, like, gay bait you to, you know, expect, you know, there'll be a gay content in this movie, which is actually just a ploy to, I don't know. I mean, maybe I'm reading too much into it, but no, I felt that was there.
No, you're quite right.
And, yeah, and, I think it was definitely
I do want to add queer baiting to its already long list of sins, which this movie's already committed. So I would try to, you know, stay away from that because I couldn't speak to that content clearly enough, but I think you're right. There are enough hints in there subliminally to actually emphasize that that might be a thing. But also on like that point where I felt postnatal depression, especially for like, you know, after pregnancy, is a serious issue, and a lot of mothers do go through that. And there is this narrative in popular culture about how children are the greatest gift of God and they're the best thing to happen to you, but nobody actually talks about the actual physical and mental toll that that takes in bringing up a child. So I think there is a sincere, honest movie in there.
Yeah, and you see it in the first half.
Yeah.
And it's refreshing to see this subject being delved into and you making you, you know, feel the tension.
Exactly.
And I'm putting you into a mind space.
And I'm not surprised this was released to coincide with Mother's Day. I think that'll be not significant, insignificant part of the audience. And some of the sequences we referred to earlier, we referred to the encounter with her husband, is something, among many others, that people can see, oh, this is what... Maybe this is something where I can empathize because I've seen people go through this, or because I've gone through it myself. And it's been interesting talking to different people about this film and the different perceptions. I found this discussion very curious and very interesting.
It's possible that people who have suffered through similar levels of stress after giving birth or on raising kids will forgive the twist simply because they're seeing somebody out there trying to express the pain and the struggle.
Yeah, but then it's not sincere. It doesn't follow through. I mean,
I agree, it doesn't. But still, maybe for some people, it'll be enough that somebody's finally tried to show this in a mainstream entertainment.
But that's the same way of saying, you know, if you have 1 minute of queer representation, that's all you need in a movie. You know, you don't need...
It would be good to see it done well.
Yeah, exactly.
Instead of twist-based narrative, yeah.
It robs you of that actual significance of what this issue could actually mean for a lot of people.
Can we talk a second about the performances? We mentioned Charlize Theron earlier. I mean, she's come off three action films, and this is a very different role, and she was excellent in this. And Mackenzie Davis, I mean, this evoked elements of a San Junipero performance, which I think was a series high. She was absolutely superb. We saw her in Blade Runner, certainly not as much of a media role. Livingston gets a lot of lip service roles, where it's kind of like, we need a guy who's in his 40s who can just sort of jump in and be the, you know, side figure. But he was a little bit meatier in this. I appreciated what Reitman managed to get out of his figures. This is the third collaboration between the pair, second with Charlize Theron. I know Chris is not a fan of Juno. I did not particularly like Juno. I didn't I was indifferent to it.
This isn't as bad as Juno, probably.
I quite like Juno, actually.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
I still prefer Young Adult to this.
Young Adult, I think, is a big step above this and a much more honest narrative. You know, that's a movie that has twists in terms of going to places you don't expect it to without trying to pull the rug out and using dishonest misdirection.
And Young Adult
tactics.
Had a pretty big twist, but the film didn't rely on the twist. It wasn't its biggest note. You could even if they hadn't had the twist in that film, you would be able to enjoy it like, almost as much and about the same impact.
And I don't feel like the twist was dishonest in that film.
No, not at all. I think it was
organic. In keeping, I think. Yeah, it was organic. I think it was in keeping with the characterization.
And I didn't see it coming
right from the beginning.
You could easily have seen it coming if you'd been
I agree.
Out.
Yeah, I feel like this movie tried to be Phantom Thread and failed.
How did it try to be Phantom Thread?
You know, in trying to be like, oh, look how we interspersed all these clues in the beginning and then have this very dark and twisted reveal, except it wasn't dark, it was just twisted and sad. And just
but the movie doesn't treat it as though it's as sad as... Maybe it is to reveal...
Wait, hang on.
I just remembered one... You reminded me of one more terrible thing about this movie.
We have time.
All right, you were talking about the dropping the clues throughout. The movie has this running thing of she keeps seeing mermaid images everywhere. Mm. She sees mermaids being spoken about on TV. Look, mommy, it's a mermaid. I don't know if that was in the movie or I just imagined something.
Yeah,
like that.
There were two mermaid references, one on the television and then the pond.
Yeah, and then seeing visions of mermaids or whatever.
Yeah.
And then when the car goes down the bridge.
Yeah, that's the pond. Sorry, the river, I should say, not
but,
pond.
Yeah, there's all these kinds of hints, and you're thinking, okay, what is this symbolism for? What does it mean? And then it's just some vision where she sees Tully as a mermaid at the end when she's driven her car off a bridge. So the mermaid doesn't actually symbolize anything. It's just a dumb attempt at artsiness that's way too self-conscious to actually register as a metaphor. It's all show, you know, for the appearance of depth, but doesn't actually really, I think, communicate anything, unless it went over my head.
I would...
No, you're right. I don't think there is anything. And basically what you're trying to say is, if you think you've got a clever twist in your screenplay, it probably isn't as clever as you think it is.
Well, look, I'll agree with you. On this point, I will agree. I felt it was thrown in. I didn't feel there was, maybe to go over my head too, but I didn't feel there was any ardent symbolism there. I think the imagery was very similar, and we've seen in some other films lately too, to what was achieved to great effect in The Sunken Place in Get Out. And I feel this is a trend that may be catching on.
That was a much better image, though.
Oh, so
and that was directly related to the thematic material that Jordan Peele was going for in that film. You know, in this, it's just like a strain for some kind of poetic imagery to anchor the film or to create interest. Because I think one of the problems with this movie is the interest, you know, early on, it builds so much tension. It feels like combustible in terms of how many things could go wrong. And there, I did feel, as I said earlier, a kind of sense of dread. Once Tully, the housekeeping night nurse, arrives, there all of that kind of tension kind of goes away because her life is suddenly completely in order. So it instead becomes about where is this going? So I think that's what they were trying to do with the mermaid, create some kind of intrigue into, you know, the hint of this is going to go somewhere. But when it ultimately does come, the mermaid really, that imagery is just once more grafted onto, you know, the twist. It doesn't end up having any actual significance. It's just there for the illusion of, and it all comes full circle and a satisfying reveal. No. But there's nothing to it.
In terms of the reveal, I've been thinking once I saw this film about some of the clues that they just drop in there. And I think if I go back and watch it, there will be even more we'll be able to discern. And I do agree that there were some lax ones, some blatant ones. But for every lax and blatant one, there was a really well-placed one. There's a great scene in the bar where in Brooklyn where the two of them go out and the barman is hitting on Tully and Marlowe's like, oh, you get it. Look, she's up to you. He's like, no, he's looking at you.
Right.
And that, in retrospect, you know, that's more touching and endearing than a lot of the other elements we
saw. I guess so. But at that point, I was just registering that as more sexual tension about, no, actually, you are really hot. And then it gets to...
Yeah, more gay baiting.
More gay baiting. And then it's building up to Marlowe saying, you know, there's something I really have to tell you.
Yeah.
I felt was really deliberately going for,
because, you know, I
love
felt,
you or I'm really attracted to you. Like, it's really setting that up. That's the moment where I felt like the gay baiting became undeniable and not just something I was suspecting.
That reminds me of this sort of very small, supposedly consequential scene, which turned out to be inconsequential, when Marlowe meets this acquaintance of hers who supposedly
is still living.
You know, but I thought she was an ex-girlfriend that she was talking about.
Right.
You know?
Yeah.
And that's when I was like, you know.
No, I didn't take that either. I took that as college roommate friend situation. That was from the dialogue.
My girlfriend, when she saw, I wasn't paying that much attention like Glenn, but my girlfriend viewed it that way.
Yes, that's how I viewed it. Especially because then she takes Tully and, you know, she goes to that place, but she was still living.
Yeah, exactly. And she's saying, you know, I really loved this woman. So with all of that, you know, I really loved her. So when all of these things come together,
I hate this movie.
You know, Marlo's gay, especially because it's suggesting that also there's not that much spark in her relationship with her husband. So you're thinking, oh, maybe she's just married a guy, but she's actually really into women who she really, really loved. And that's why she's discovering herself. Exactly. But no, this was just a misdirection.
I went in a completely other direction, and I'm sure others will take any number of views of this film. It is in cinemas now. Please go see it and discuss and debate and let us know what you think of it. We will be back, as we said, next week with Sydney Film Festival director Nash and Moodley talking about very different films that will be screening at the festival over the coming months. There are tickets available and we will be there at the Hub, and it's getting exciting for the next few weeks. We'll be talking about
to us at the Hub. We're real people.
Yeah, we'll be there all the time pretty much. Yeah. So just drop by, just yell out, Film Fight Club, where are you?
Yeah, we're real and nice, and we can actually talk in real life as well. We're not socially awkward.
We don't fight all the time.
You can put together the qualities of, like, nerd, knowledge, and radio, and Captain Planet will be summoned.
Look for the whirling ball of fists, and please subscribe on iTunes. This has been Glenn Fountain, Chris Evans of Ratneru. Enjoy movies. Have a wonderful night. Good night.
Goodbye. Laters.